So Tarun got obtained his PhD at MIT in 2010, then after a first postdoc at UC Berkeley until 2012, he started his current postdoc at KITP, and he's currently a Moore postdoctoral fellow. Today he will talk about highly entangled quantum matter. Tarun?
Thank you so much for the introduction. Thank you for being here. Let's get started. So this is the title of my talk, so let's just start straight away. So this is the introduction to my... So first I will talk about introduction to quantum spin liquids, and then I will... The second part will be about entanglement and topological Barry phase, and finally I'll talk about stability of these quantum spin liquids. So let's start by reminding ourselves that most phases of matter order in some way or another. For example, if you have take any crystal, and if you put it under a microscope, you will notice that it has this repeating pattern of some unit cell. Similarly, if you take a ferromagnet and again look at it very microscopically, you will notice that it has this repeating pattern of ordered spins. So it's a very basic question. Is there some general theorem of some kind that all things order at zero temperature, zero meaning zero Kelvin? In fact, the answer is no, and that's the topic of my talk. So these things which don't order even at zero temperature go by the name of quantum liquids. That is, they don't break any symmetry, so they don't have any repeating pattern of any kind underlying. So they are actually more than one example. Not only do they exist, in fact, there are more than one such things. So the most prominent example are quantum Hall liquids. And then there are these very popular materials called topological insulators, which are also quantum liquids. The one which I will talk a lot in this talk are quantum spin liquids. These are phases of matter where the elementary degrees of freedom are quantum spins. For example, on some lattice. Here is some triangular lattice, and you see the spin on every lattice side, and they're highly fluctuating. They don't order in any way. So these are at least three different kinds of quantum liquids. So how do you actually understand these quantum liquids? So here is one of my favorite quotes by Vicky Viskov, and he has some thought experiment in his mind. Maybe a slightly brutal kind of experiment where some theoretical physicists are actually enclosed in some building. They are not allowed to go out. And he asks, what can they predict using basic physics? They have all the laws of physics. What can they do using it? So he's very optimistic. He thinks that you'll be able to predict existence of atoms, molecules, even collective phenomena like metals, insulators. But he thinks that you will not be able to predict existence of liquids. And the reason is that because liquids don't have, liquids are the phases where interactions are really very important. When you have things like solids, because of symmetry breaking, interactions at very low energy don't remain that effective. So that's what he had in mind. So how does one understand these quantum liquids, given that they are so hard? I will argue that quantum entanglement provides the key to understand quantum liquids. So what is quantum entanglement? So the most famous example of quantum entanglement is an EPR pair. So here are these two, here take two spins, put them in this state, up, down, minus, down, up, and we call these two spins are entangled. And the reason we say it, because if you do a measurement on the first spin, and a subsequent measure on the second spin actually depends on the outcome of the first measurement. For example, if you measure it to be up, and then you measure the second spin, you will always find it to be down. So that's why they are entangled. So their measurements are entangled. But this is just one example. One would like a more general framework where one can, given some wave function, you can tell whether it's entangled or not. So the way we do, and I'm sure all of you have seen it before, but just for the background, you have some system, which is say union of a and a bar, And we are interested in knowing how is region, or how is the Hilbert space A entangled with Hilbert space in A bar. So first one takes the overall wave function for the total system, let me call it psi, trace out A bar, get a reduced density matrix for A, and then define the von Neumann entanglement entropy in this way, minus trace rho A log rho A. So this captures the entanglement between region A and A bar. And S is zero if and only if psi is a product state. So if decomposes into phi A tensor product phi A bar, then it's, then entanglement is exactly zero. So if you take your spin half, this the what I just showed you in the previous slide, this for this entanglement entropy is log two, which is a maximum it can be for a single spin. So this is an explicit demonstration of that. You take this EPR pair, get a reduced density metric for the, for example, for the first spin, and you find there are two terms in it, up up plus down down. And the physical meaning that there are two terms is that there are two ways to quantum fluctuate. And if you look at entanglement entropy, that is log two. The log of number of ways system can fluctuate. So we want to take this intuition further and want to apply it to many body systems, which is what we are interested in. So let's consider a system which where the symmetry is broken. So this is a, suppose some ferromagnet, and I'm interested in knowing how is there a region A entangled with A bar. So it's a simple calculation, you can just do it because there are no really quantum fluctuations here as you see, and it gets captured correctly by the quantum entanglement. You look at a reduced density matrix for region A, you get just one term. So it tells you that there really no quantum fluctuation and the entanglement entropy is correspondingly zero. So it does, entanglement entropy is log of one, which is zero, because there is just one way to fluctuate. And there's a general moral here that when symmetry is broken, typically you tend to reduce entanglement because you, things look more and more classical. You just freeze into one configuration. One exception, of course, is if we have Goldstone modes, then that's not correct, and that will play important role later on. But at a zeroth order level, symmetry breaking tends to reduce entanglement because you just freeze into one state. So the question is how to generate quantum entanglement if symmetry breaking tends to reduce it. So here's one way. You take this ferromagnet and apply some global rotation on it and add that term. So it's suppose all up plus all down. So this has more entanglement now between region A and A bar if you calculate it. But this is a weird state. It's like a Schrodinger cat. You're superposing two things which are macroscopically distinct. And this is very unstable. If you change your Hamiltonian slightly, you will find that either you will preferentially pick this kind of states or these kind of states, because it's just hard to entangle macroscopically large things. So this is unphysical. So we want to, but it has the right essence. So let's take it further and try to make something more physical out of it. So here's a stable version of Schrodinger cat. So you take these cats and superpose them in all possible modes of the cat, not just say. So first of all, here, so let's say this is a happy cat, this is slightly less happy than a neutral cat and slightly puzzled and maybe a sad cat. So if you do that, then there's a factor of 1 over square root n in front, and n is much, much greater than 1. If you own a cat, you know it probably. But that means that you can, there's no contradiction here. If you change Hamiltonian, it remains stable because of this suppression for each possibility here. And in actual condensed matter system, actually this is a basic idea behind so-called quantum spin liquids. So these are phases of matter where you get such stable version of Schrodinger cats, and the way I will go in detail very soon. But very broadly speaking, these quantum spin liquids are phases of matter where fundamental degrees of freedom are spins, say on some lattice, some spin half spins. And they are strongly quantum fluctuating. So there is no ordering, even at zero temperature. And there are strong quantum fluctuations. And now there are many experimental systems which seem to have this behavior. So here are two different examples, in fact, three of them. So these two come from a family of materials which are known by the name of organic salts, like Kappa-ET salts. And the phase diagram looks like this. If you apply pressure, if you decrease pressure, first it's a normal metal, Fermi liquid, then it becomes a superconductor, and finally it becomes a spin liquid, which has seemingly have gapless excitations. And why do we say it has gapless excitations? Because people actually look at its thermal conductivity. So this is a slightly different material, this one, but it's related to it. Both of these are spin liquids. So if y-axis is thermal conductivity divided by temperature, and it goes to a constant as a function of temperature, it's T squared here. So this pink curve is a putative quantum spin liquid. And generally, if you have a system which doesn't have electronic degrees of freedom, here they are just spins. There are no freely moving electrons. The right expectation is that the thermal conductivity goes to zero. Like these are two canonical examples here, it goes to zero. But in these systems, the thermal conductivity at low temperature looks like as if it has some fluctuating electrons, even though the fundamental degree of freedom are just spins. So it's an example of a gapless spin liquid. And here's another example. These are Kagome lattice materials, where people did neutron scattering, and they find that there's no ordering again. And this is a signature of it's a highly fluctuating quantum liquid. So there are no sharp peaks in the neutron scattering, which is a signature of it being highly fluctuating. So there are now many materials and a lot of motivation to study these things. And let me broadly divide these quantum spin liquid into two classes, what I call gap quantum liquids and gapless quantum liquids. In the gap quantum liquids, there are one or two low-lying ground states. And above that, there is a finite gap in the thermodynamic limit. This remains finite in thermodynamic limit. And the prominent example is quantum Hall phases, which are incompressible liquids, and they have finite energy gap. And the other class is gapless spin liquid, where the spectrum is spectrum has many, many low-lying excitations. And as I just tried to motivate, that these organic spin liquids fall into this class, because they have, at low temperature, large thermal conductivity, which tells you there are many things which are moving around. So let's think about gap spin liquid, which are easier to understand. And let me relate it to what I just said. They're like stable version of Schrodinger cats. So here's one example of a gap spin liquid. Take our triangular lattice and then tile it with EPR pairs. So each bond here, each blue color dimer here is actually a EPR singlet of spins. So they are spin half on every lattice. So I can tile the lattice in many, many ways. And let me superpose all those possible ways. So this is one way of tiling the lattice. Then the second way, I just do some local move. And then I keep on doing it and do it in all possible ways, and then sum them up. This is a wave function. There's a superposition of all things. And this is an exact analog of the stable version of Schrodinger cat. So we want to understand it better, what's going on in this spin liquid. So one way to bring out the physics correctly is to notice that each configuration here can be thought of as a configuration of closed loops. So one way to bring out these closed loops is to subtract out some reference configuration. This is just a guide to the eye. You don't have to do it if you know how these things work, but it helps you bring out this fact that they are closed loops. So just superpose these two things, and you see they are closed loops. I'm just taking this picture and putting it on top of it. So you will find that always they are closed loops. And so the ground state wave function is sum of all possible closed loops. One interesting property of this closed loop configuration is that if you draw some region A, suppose this is some shaded region A, which is brown colored region, if you look at its boundary, it will always have even number of intersections with the loops, because they are closed. So 1, 2, 3, 4 here. And so because of this closed loop constraint, there are always even number of intersections. And this is a way to bring out the physics of gap spin liquid using quantum entanglement. Because recall that entanglement entropy again requires dividing system into two parts, A and complement of A. So this gives you some idea. If you look at the entanglement entropy of the gap spin liquids, it may have some signatures because of this closed loop constraint. So that's what happens. So the result is this, which was initially found in these papers, you take this gap quantum spin liquid and look at the entanglement between some shaded region and the rest of it. It will have the following form. Leading term is proportional to the linear length of the system. There is a subleading term gamma, which captures this constraint on the boundary that there are even number of intersections, or in general, the generalized version of that for general spin liquids. So it basically counts log of number of constraints on the boundary of region A. So this gamma, that's what it captures. And the leading term is, of course, proportional to L because of boundary law of entanglement entropy, but that's not a very interesting term because it depends on the UV cutoff. This term gamma is independent of the UV cutoff. So it's universal. It's same for all wave functions in a given phase of matter. So in a given phase of matter, there are infinite number of wave functions because the phase diagram is finite, but this gamma doesn't change. So that's the, so it's a topological invariant for the corresponding phase. It's not a property of just the wave function, but a whole phase. And when gamma 1 is not equal to gamma 2, because of this reason that it's a property of the phase, it implies they are distinct phases. So this answers the question I posed in the beginning, that how to understand quantum liquids. So this gives you some insight that if these topological invariants can capture the fact that these things are highly fluctuating. And it's called topological invariant for two different reasons. It's stable under perturbations of Hamiltonian, and the second reason is that the coefficient of this term, gamma, it only depends on number of boundaries. So it's quantized. So you might think that, okay, the leading term has no physics. There is one small subleading term, and you are hoping that captures all the interesting physics. So why should I care about this subleading term? That sounds a bit counterintuitive. Okay, this one term sitting there, it knows about some highly fluctuating quantum liquid. And here's a general argument why you should always get surprised when you see a subleading constant term in entanglement for a gap system. Suppose a system could be described by only local correlation functions. It's a fully gapped system. You might have thought, if I know the local physics, I know everything about it. But it turns out that's a misleading thing if there's a subleading term in entanglement. And the way it works is this. So if the physics is really local, you should be able to write down entanglement entropy as integral of some local functional over the boundary. And local functional of the local curvature and its derivatives. So there is some local curvature here. And you should be able to write down entanglement entropy as just some kind of Taylor series expansion in it. But if you do it, the one thing you notice is that there's a big constraint on this F, and it's the symmetry is just quantum mechanics, that S, there's no, it's not like some new symmetry, it just follows from basic quantum mechanics, that S of region A is S of complement of A. This implies that F of kappa is actually even in the curvature kappa. If you use that information and plug it in, you find that the constant term is actually not allowed in any gap phase. So this tells you whenever you see a constant term in entanglement entropy in a gap phase, it must come from some non-local physics. You can't have that just because of local fluctuations. So let's get back to more condensed matter point of view on these spin liquids. And we want to know how to realize them in actual nature. Where should I look if I'm interested in this physics? So it turns out, since I started talking about these quantum spin liquids as fluctuating EPR pairs on some triangular lattice, one place where you have something very close to it is actually a superconductor, because superconductor is a condensate of EPR pairs. But there is one catch, that when you have superconductor, you don't have dimer covering on some lattice. You also have things which sit on the same side. You can have up and down spin sitting on the same side, which are indicated by these circles, these filled blue circles. So there's EPR singlet sitting on the same side. And this actually violates this constraint equation that I mentioned, that if you draw some region A and draw some, look at the intersections with the boundary, you will find that the fact that these things exist on the same side, it does not make it look like a closed loop configuration. So we want to get rid of this. So let me do it. So the idea is that I start from a superconductor, then build on local interactions so that such terms are not allowed because of energetical reasons. And then our belief is that this is one way to get these highly fluctuating quantum spin liquids. And in fact, even in experiments, these things often sit next to a superconductor. So think of this axis, when you reduce the pressure, as making these configurations less and less energetically favorable. So then you'll be only left with configurations which are first and third and so on, where they're only closed loop configurations. And this is an old idea, originally proposed by Anderson in 1973. Till the notion of entanglement entropy came into business, no one actually checked this idea. No one knew whether it's actually correct or not. So let's try to check whether it actually holds or not. So I take this wave function, exactly this wave function. I take a superconductor and then prohibit these configurations where two electrons hit on the same side. So it's called projected BCS superconductor. So projected meaning you're projecting out these configurations. And if you think from a field theory point of view, we know what a low energy theory should look like. That's our belief, that it's some Chern-Simons theory, because it's some topological field theory. For this particular wave function that we studied in this paper, the predicted answer from the field theory point of view was that this subleading term gamma should be log of square root 2, which follows from k is equal to Chern-Simons theory. And we actually, now if you put this wave function on the lattice and try to check whether that actually holds or not, you find that the answer is indeed yes, that when your subsystem length L is much, much bigger than the correlation length, your subleading term gamma actually asymptotes to log of square root 2. So this connects this two very disparate ways of thinking of spin liquid. One is topological field theory, and other in terms of microscopic wave functions. And it seems like Anderson got it correct 40 years ago, that a projected spin liquid, a projected superconductor indeed looks like a spin liquid. Not just in some heuristic way, but in a very precise sense of topological entanglement entropy. So let me come to the second part here in gap spin liquids. As I just mentioned, if gamma 1 and gamma 2 are not same, it implies that they are distinct phases. But other way around is not correct. You can have two distinct phases, for which gamma is actually exactly same. So how does one characterize these phases in a more fine-grained manner? So again, entanglement is actually very important, and the connection comes from noticing that the excitations in these phases are anions. These are phases. So what are anions? Anions are excitations which are neither bosons or fermions. And the way it works is you take one anion and take it around another anion, you pick up some Barry phase, which is unlike a boson or fermion. For example, if you take a fermion and take it around another fermion fully, you don't get any phase. Only when you exchange them, then you get a minus one sign. But in the case of anions, if you take one anion around another anion, you pick up some Barry phase. And the question I want to address is that if I'm just given the ground state wave function, can you see these anions? Which is the viewpoint I'm taking here, that ground state should encode everything about the phase. So let's see how it works. So first thing to notice is that when there are anions in the system, then they are degenerate ground states on torus. And the way it works is that you start from one ground state, then create an anion-anti-anion pair, and then take it around and annihilate it. So that generates an orthogonal ground state. Similarly, you can do in various other directions, and you generate a whole manifold of ground state degenerate set of ground states on the torus. And we want to know whether, just given these ground states on the torus, can I pull out all the universal information about the anions? So let's try to attempt this program. So first thing to notice is that what I'm interested in the mutual statistics Sij, which is the Barry phase of anion I around j, and One way to reformulate this Barry phase is to consider two ground states, capital sigma I and capital sigma j. What I mean is that this capital sigma I is a ground state where ith anion winds around x hat direction. So how do I generate this ground state? I took anion of kind I and this anti-anion pair, created them out of vacuum, took it around, and then annihilated it. So that's why this string is left. Similarly, I do it for the anion j around the y direction. So these are two very different ground states. And it turns out the mutual statistics, Sij, of which is this Barry phase of anion I around j, is given by this overlap. And that you can justify, you can do it rigorously using topological field theory. But pictorially, you can see if you superimpose these two things, you find anion j is going around y direction, anion I along x direction. So that picks up this mutual Barry phase. And we want to see whether one can carry out this whole program given arbitrary ground state wave function in some arbitrary basis. Because you will never have access to this basis a priori. There's some special basis, capital sigma, which you don't have any knowledge beforehand. So we want to see how to get these capital sigmas. So that's the question I'm posing. How to find these capital sigma wave functions just given some arbitrary basis for the ground state. So this is a key observation that these states, capital sigma, have a very special property that actually they minimize entanglement entropy for some generic wave function expanded in some general basis for a cut which is perpendicular to x hat direction. So draw some region A which has non-contractible boundaries. So its boundaries are non-contractible on torus. And it turns out one can show that if I write down some general wave function and ask when is the entanglement entropy minimized for this cut, it will be exactly those wave functions which are these capital sigmas. So this relates these two very different ideas of entanglement entropy of just ground state wave functions and these anions. And the intuition is that when entanglement entropy is minimum, you have maximum knowledge of anionic content. Think about entropy as your lack of knowledge about a system, heuristically. The same thing is true for entanglement entropy. The bigger the entanglement entropy, the less you know about the state. Similarly, so here we are trying to minimize entanglement entropy, and that means maximum knowledge of anionic content. So here's one demonstration. Consider the simplest possible spin liquid where there are just two ground states. Let me call them 1 and 2, and then superpose them. Let me call them cos phi 1 and sine phi 2. So 1 and 2 is some arbitrary basis, which came out for example, some exact diagonalization or some DMRG study. And once I superpose these two things, and I want to know what angle phi will minimize the entanglement entropy perpendicular to the cut. That will give me these capital sigmas. So you can do it numerically, as we did in this paper. You find some oscillating curve as a function of angle phi, and you look at this minima. You can find another one by just actually symmetry in this case. And then you look at this S matrix, which is this overlap of capital sigmas, which are obtained by plugging in this angle phi. And you find this is the mutual statistics of anions. There's just one non-trivial anion here. And that is found numerically in this by this method by noticing that the diagonal element of Sij here is minus, its phase factor is minus 1. That means if I just exchange these two anions, you pick up a phase of I or minus I. I square is minus 1. Or another way, if I take it fully around another anion, you get a minus 1 sign. So that's the meaning of this e to the power I pi here. So this is pretty remarkable because you're only given the ground state wave functions. And very naively speaking, you might have thought that anionic statistics is not there in the wave function because it's a property of the of excited states, these anions. But using this trick of minimizing entanglement perpendicular to the cut, you see that you can get what you were after. So this is in fact, you can take it further and characterize a topologically ordered phase in two dimensions fully using these ideas. So I won't go into that, but let me But this gives you a basic idea. So let me move on to the last part of my talk. Make sure I'm on time. So yeah. So which is stability of gapless quantum spin liquids. So as I earlier advertised, there are two kinds of spin liquids. One are gap spin liquids, and then there is gapless spin liquids. So these gap spin liquids are much more easier to understand compared to this because there is a gap. So you can, for example, you can even talk perturbatively its properties. Once you understand the fixed point property, you can move around it and calculate anything you want for this space. But for these gapless spin liquids, often there are no perturbative tools. They are much less well understood, and we don't even know whether they are stable or not. That's the most basic question, whether they even exist or not. These things clearly exist. For example, quantum Hall exists. For these questions have been asked in the past whether they are stable or not, because they are gapless. When things are gapless, often they are instabilities. So first thing I want to advertise is that gapless spin liquids are the low energy description of gapless spin liquids, as far as we understand, to the best of our knowledge, are emergent gauge theories. So why do you get emergent gauge theories? And the basic idea is this, behind these gapless spin liquids. So on the lattice scale level, you have some bosons or electrons hopping on some lattice. And what happens because of strong interactions is that these bosons break apart into smaller pieces, which I call partons. When these partons interact with each other by some gauge field. So the simpler analogy is think of proton as bound state of three quarks at heuristic level. And imagine a world where quarks were deconfined at low energies. For example, suppose your number of flavors were much, much bigger than number of colors. So that's analog of this gapless quantum spin liquids, that you have some degree of freedom at a lattice scale, at your UV scale, and because of strong interactions at low energy, it breaks up into smaller pieces, which are called partons, and they deconfine. And the low energy theory, as you expect, then it's some interacting gauge theory. So I will focus on one class of spin liquids, which I will call QED spin liquids, because their low energy theory is just quantum electrodynamics in 2+1 dimension, not 3+1 like in our universe, but I'm interested in much more strongly interacting systems, much more highly entangled systems, so that's why I want to restrict myself to 2+1 dimension, where things are much less understood. So here the low energy theory is emergent Dirac fermions coupled to emergent light, emergent photons. So why do I focus on this case? It turns out there are actual lattice models people have written down, where it has been, at least, people have tried to make the case that a low energy theory is exactly some quantum electrodynamics of some emergent fermions. So here's some model written in this work by Philippe Corbos, and it's some honeycomb lattice where there are two kinds of spins, S and T, and this is the Hamiltonian, and they did some numerical study of this model, and they find that to the best of their accuracy, it looks like the low energy theory is some Dirac spin liquid. It's some QED kind of spin liquid. And then there's old work by Assad, where he wrote down somewhat similar models, where again it was argued that low energy theory is perhaps a quantum electrodynamics in 2+1D. And then there's experimental motivation also. People have argued, for example, in these papers, that the low energy theory of this Kagome spin liquid could well be a Dirac spin liquid. It is a opposing theory, a competing theory, where this Dirac spin liquid is gapped out because of gauge fluctuations, and it opens a gap. But these two are the two things in the market. We don't know which of them is correct, but at least numerically, this phase of matter where this Kagome spins break apart into smaller fermions seems to be very stable, at least at a level of numerics. So there is even if you don't know what this material actually does, this is a good motivation to understand the stability of these spin liquids. So what is the phase diagram of QED spin liquids? So this is a low energy theory. It's some fermions coupled to some U1 gauge field. And there are NF number of these fermions. You may ask, how does this NF comes about? What is this NF? So it turns out when in condensed matter, this NF is not a tuning parameter. NF is fixed. And the way NF arises is you write down your, suppose, for example, Kogomei-Lattice Heisenberg model and do some mean field theory. And only a particular mean field theory will give you a Dirac spin liquid. And in that mean field theory, NF is fixed. It just comes from some band structure calculation. And on the other hand, if I look at what is known about such theories, it is known that when NF is, say, zero, or close to zero, we believe such phases are unstable. We believe such field theory is confined in some way. That is, emergent degrees of freedom no longer are well defined. And when NF is, say, close to infinity, it is known that these fermions are deconfined. So depending on whether your NF in the material lies here or here, spin liquid will exist or not exist. So it's a very basic question, critical value of NF above which we believe spin liquid is stable. So why is this a hard problem? It's a hard problem because if you are in 3 plus 1D, this 3D means 3 plus 1D here, then your fine structure constraint is small, it's 1 over 137, but the analog of fine structure constraint, just your coupling constraint, is order 1 in 2 plus 1D. So that makes it very, very hard to calculate anything. So that's the reason this is a very old open question, how to determine stability of this gauge theory. So how does one determine stability? How does one determine stability of anything? So one way is to just go ahead and write down all possible Feynman diagrams. Let's just start calculating it. This is pretty good, but just joking. So what I will use is a different path here, which is to use some recent amazing developments in quantum field theory, which constrain RG flows. So as has been argued in this work, and in particular by Cassini-Hirta in this work, that if I look at the entanglement entropy for a circle, for a Lorentz invariant system, then the sublating term gamma, which is exactly like your topological entanglement entropy, but now it's much more general, it applies to both gapless and gapped Lorentz invariant systems, this number gamma decreases under RG flow. So if phase one is unstable to phase two, then it is required that gamma one be bigger than or equal to gamma two. So this goes by the name of F theorem, or I will just call entanglement monotonicity. It tells you something about the phase diagram, just knowing the entanglement entropy of the final and initial fixed points. So pictorially, this is the landscape of all Lorentz invariant theories. For example, here's a gapless theory. This is another gapless theory. And the height of these peaks is gamma. So gapless phase two cannot be unstable to gapless one because it has lower height, lower gamma. And similarly, this topologically ordered phase for which gamma is exactly this topological entanglement entropy is fully stable. It cannot be unstable to anything. Perturbatively, it's fully stable because there's a gap. So it shows up as these valleys in this landscape. It's fully stable. So let me give an example, the kind of insights this theorem gives us into condensed matter questions. So let's take graphene. Graphene, the low energy theory is actually 4 Dirac nodes. So, the question one can ask is, if I add infinitesimal perturbations, can you break all the symmetries spontaneously? So it's some SU4 symmetry. Can you break it spontaneously for infinitesimal interactions and generate a gap? So this is a very easy question for most of us. We know the answer already. It cannot occur if you do just power counting for the scaling dimensions. But let me rederive this result just to show the power of this F theorem, because there are cases where you won't have this benefit of the scaling dimensions. So it's good to know how it works in a simple case and then apply to a much complex case. So when symmetry is, SU4 symmetry is fully broken, you generate 15 Goldstone modes. So gamma is the sublating term. which is also called F in literature. So F for, or gamma for Dirac fermion is 0.22 around for the accuracy I need. For that, for a scalar boson is 0.06. So if you calculate total F for this, it's 0.88. Hey, it's 0.90. Because it's 15 times 0.06 is 0.90. 0.22 times 4 is 0.88. So you cannot have this RG flow. Infinitesimal perturbations cannot gap this out. So it's not allowed. It's a simple demonstration, even though we know the answer. But it tells you that you have reduced some very, I mean, if you have to teach it to high school students, you have to teach them the whole course on RG flows and scaling dimensions to tell this. But here, if you're thinking in this point, if it's just numerology, just counting problem. So it's much more simpler. So let me apply this idea to the stability of QED3, which is my main concern here. So here's a heuristic argument, then we can make it more precise. If I think in some large NF limit, then gamma for QED3 is proportional to NF at a leading order. NF is number of flavors of fermions, while gamma for the Goldstone mode is NF squared roughly. So this gives you a rough estimate for NF critical, above which this phase cannot be unstable to this phase. And that's given by just matching the coefficient of these two terms. And you find it's two times this ratio of two universal numbers, which is gamma of free Dirac fermion and gamma of free Dirac scalar, around 3.5, and you get around 8. So it tells you that this phase cannot, and the reason I assume this instability, there's no other instability I assume, because I'm using some insight from, there's this theorem called Wafer-Witten theorem. It tells you, if you gap these fermions out, what is the pattern of symmetry breaking? And that pattern of symmetry breaking is, if there's NF fermions, there's a UNF symmetry, and Wafer and Witten told us that the pattern symmetry breaking is UNF over 2 times UNF over 2. That gives me the coefficient here. What should be a coefficient? So now, let me try to, so this was just a heuristic argument. It already is pretty good because NF is around 8, and that's already large. So large NF argument should not be completely off. But let's try to have an exact upper bound on the stability of this QED3 by some sandwiching procedure. By sandwiching, I mean, so interacting QED3, I don't know the exact NF, its exact gamma, because I know the leading term, maybe the subleading terms also I can calculate perturbatively, but I don't know the exact answer. So let me try to sandwich this theory between two other theories. So the sandwiching procedure I sandwich it between some supersymmetric theory, which is called some chiral QED3, and final fixed point is same. If it becomes unstable, it goes to some Goldstone mode phase. And I know the number of Goldstone modes here, again, by Wafer-Witten theorem. And the flow from here to here, you can argue, at least you can control it at large enough. And if you make reasonable assumptions, there's really nothing else can happen, I think. So then you have two equations, that gamma of SQD3 is bigger than gamma of QD3 plus gamma Dirac. I can tell you why this extra comes later. It's related to the extra gauge, you know, in this phase. And there's an extra equation that gamma of QD3 is bigger than gamma of Goldstone mode. I'm just applying F theorem to this flow and this flow separately. Then you get an inequality. You can just cancel this out by adding these inequalities. And you find that, and the reason I sandwich it between this fixed point and this fixed point, even though this supersymmetric QD3 have nothing to do with condensed matter, the good point is that this fixed point, I know exactly the F value, or the gamma value. Gamma of this SQD3 is known exactly using work by Klebanov and collaborator, so it's some exact number we know. So once you sandwich it, then you find that spin liquid is stable for NF bigger than 30. So this is a, so we don't know what happens below than this, because it's a no-go theorem tells you what can't happen, but at least you know when it's stable. And you can actually improve this bound under certain more assumption, which I can go in more detail, by trying to sandwich it between some really simple theory, between some free photons and fermions. It has some issue, this theory, because it's not conformal, because free photons have some log term in it, in its entanglement. But if you make some assumptions on the RG flow, which I think are reasonable, then you find that you can improve this bound, and you find spin liquid is stable for NF bigger than 7. So this is what the question we posed: when is spin liquid stable? So we now have some handle on this problem in a non-perturbative way. So it has some implications for condensed matter systems. As I earlier, just to remind you once more, then so it means that when NF is, if I take this bound which I just mentioned, 7, if I take it seriously, then it tells you that when NF is bigger than 7, then you have this deconfined phase, which is stable spin liquid. And you can actually generalize all these arguments to these old questions of stability of abelian and abelian, non-abelian gauge theories. And you actually recover what you would have thought, the rough intuition you would have, that when number of colors is much, much bigger, number of flavors is much bigger than number of colors, you would expect it to be stable. And actually, you get the same result using this non-perturbative arguments. So you can repeat the same argument I just said. So coming back to more condensed matter questions, for example, for this system, NF was 8, so we believe, I think it's most likely stable, this space, unless something is very weird going on at a lattice scale. Just to mention that, because why do I say that something weird can happen at a lattice scale? For example, all of these arguments require that a low energy theory is Lorentz invariant, so I'm assuming that all the instabilities of this theory can be described within that framework. That same assumption goes into C theorem. We apply C theorem very glibly all the time to lattice models, but one has to be careful that lattice models are not Lorentz invariant, only the low energy theory is. Most RG flows we know can be described by just using the low energy theory. So I've not seen any counterexample, but it's good to keep in mind that everything is on a lattice. So if I with this caveat, this is stable, I think. And on the other hand, for this Kagome lattice spin liquid, NF is 4, so I don't know the answer. Because this bound only tells what happens above this. It doesn't tell you what happens below this. It tells you what is sufficient, how much NF is sufficient to get you deconfined. So let me come to the final application, if I have 5 more minutes or 10 more minutes. Seems like I do. It's a much more, I would say, simpler argument, very quick argument. So I'm interested in quantum phase transitions of the following kind. On one side, at zero temperature, I have a system which has topological order. By that, I mean it has non-zero topological entanglement entropy in 2 plus 1 dimension. On the other side, I have some symmetry broken phase. Let's say some spin half antiferromagnet. And I want to rule out, I want to put some strong constraints on what this phase transition is. What is its nature of transition? And this question is motivated actually by actual experiments. In this Kagome lattice, as it has been argued, at least some part of the phase diagram is a gapped spin liquid, Z2 spin liquid. And by tuning some spin orbit coupling, which is D over J, some number, D is a Zaleshnikov-Moria interaction, if you're wondering, J is a Heisenberg coupling, and you can go into such symmetry broken phase. And you can check it numerically. People have done a lot of numerics on this. And this is very believable. So it's good to know what these quantum phase transitions look like between a topologically ordered phase and some antiferromagnetic phase. So if you were living in, say, 1960s, if you had not thought about entanglement much, the naive guess is it's actually O3 Wilson-Fischer fixed point. Because here is a symmetry broken phase. Here is a phase which doesn't break any symmetries. So you can just do Landau-Ginzburg theory for this transition, and you find it's O3 Wilson-Fischer. What else it could be? Because there's some order parameter description for this phase. You write down just Landau expansion for this field theory, and that's it. But it turns out that guess is incorrect. It cannot be correct ever because of this F theorem. So if it were O3 critical, you can access it by Gaussian fixed point by flowing down. That's what we understood about. That's what Wilson told us in 1970s. You can access this RG flow. On the one side, you flow to topologically ordered phase for which gamma is bounded from below by log of square root 2. This is the minimum entanglement entropy, topological entanglement entropy for any topological phase. It's 0.35. It cannot be less than this. That's the simplest abelian phase for which it is log of square root 2, which is k is equal to Chern-Simons theory. On the other hand, gamma for the Gaussian fixed point is 0.18. So clearly, you can't go from 0.18 down to 0.35 because this number gamma should decrease under RG. So it tells you that O3 transition is actually impossible. And this is a very useful guide. It is a general message here that phase transitions out of topologically ordered phase or some symmetry broken phase always lie beyond some Landau-Ginzburg kind of paradigm. In fact, we understand such phase transitions better now. We don't have a full understanding, but it tells you your first guess is incorrect because of this theorem. So in the last just 5 minutes, so tomorrow actually I'm giving a much longer talk on this topic. So I will just flash some of the just general results about application of similar ideas of entanglement and RG to systems which are not relativistic invariant. So generally, most of the work in this field has been on Lorentz invariant systems, and there is no analog of stronger F-theorem or F-theorem-like things for non-relative systems, but there are always consequences of entanglement and so-called strong subadditivity for all systems. So let me show one example where even for no Lorentz invariants, not even translation invariants, you can derive exact results on critical phenomena using entanglement. So the context here is strongly interacting and disordered quantum phases. So you have some free electrons, first two terms, and then some interactions, and the second term is disorder. So mu I depends on the lattice site, and it has been argued that the phase diagram of such system looks like this. If I think in terms of eigenstates, that there is a phase which is ergodic, like most phases are. We generally believe all phases are ergodic, in fact. But it has been argued that when disorder is very strong, system becomes localized, even at finite energy density, which is a very big surprise. Generally, you think Anderson localization occurs only at zero temperature, but these papers argue that it survives even at finite energy density. So this is energy density of eigenstates. Let me be slow here. Take one of these Hamiltonians, look at its spectrum. So what has been argued is that the low-lying spectrum is fully localized, that entanglement entropy of all these low-lying eigenstates follow an area law, which is very surprising, because generally think of area law as a property of the ground state. What has been argued is that area law survives up to finite energy density, which is almost like finite temperature, up to some critical value, and after that you get an ergodicity. So you think of one point here on the x-axis as one of these spectrum. So one point here is one Hamiltonian because it fixes mu, let's say. And you look up, low-lying spectrum is area law, higher-lying spectrum is volume law. So it's a very interesting transition from an area law states to volume law states. It's called many-body localization phase transition. And I want to know something about this transition. So I will again use the intuition from entanglement. Then if I sit close to a transition on the ergodic side, that at short distances, entanglement entropy should be universal. If it's a second order transition, it will be universal entanglement of the critical point. By short, I mean less than correlation length. And if you are much bigger than correlation length, you should recover entanglement entropy of the ergodic phase. So this is known because we understand ergodic phases quite well. So this is the known thing, this is unknown thing. This is what I'm interested in. I'm interested in the entanglement entropy at the phase transition. When this red dot intersects this curve, when I come down here. All right, so let me try to guess the answer. So these are all possible ways things can happen. At short distances in the critical regime, entanglement could be area, let's do 1D. This is 1 plus 1D. So in 1D, the volume of entanglement is just linear in L. So that's why entanglement entropy of the ergodic phase is proportional to L. And its coefficient is fixed. It's just thermal entropy. That's the meaning of ergodicity. That in the ergodic phase, entanglement entropy is just thermal entropy density times L. So its slope is fully fixed. At short distances, it could be area law, or it could be something which is second derivative is negative, but it's still not constant. It could be a linear, but slope less than thermal, or it could be linear with slope more than thermal entropy. So these are except one possibility. I've written down all possibilities if you go through the argument. It's very simple. What do you do next? I mean, I've not written down any Hamiltonian, I'm not doing any field theory. Maybe this is the last slide, I don't know. But let's just try to see if I can do something more. So it turns out entanglement entropy sets just very simple argument. Entanglement entropy as a function of L satisfied this inequality in a translation invariant system. So this is, perhaps you have seen it before, but this is a very simple argument that S of A1, basically it's applying this so-called strong subadditivity argument. strong sorority to these regions A1 and A2. So A1 is length L, A2 is length, again length L, but shifted by delta L. So you apply strong sorority, subadditivity, and you obtain this condition. Your second derivative is negative. But this is used translation invariance. I'm interested in non-translation invariant systems. So you can actually generalize it to non-translation invariant systems, as I will argue tomorrow. If you are interested in the talk, you can hear it in more detail. So let's believe that it's correct, that a second derivative is negative, even in a disordered system. Then you rule out these three possibilities. And there's only one possibility I have not ruled out here. So let me rule out that also tomorrow, not here. But it turns out the slope is bounded from above by thermal entropy density, and that follows from positivity of relative entropy. So you can rule out this also. There's only one possibility left, that the entire entropy at a critical point must be fully ergodic. It's a surprising result, because you are sitting next to a fully localized phase, and time entropy is area law, and at a critical point, you recover full ergodicity. And it's forced upon you without writing down any field here or anything, just from strong subadditivity of entanglement. So let me finish. Whatever I mentioned about many-body localization was too fast. I will tomorrow cover it in much more detail. So the general outlook that spin liquids are stable Schrodinger cats. They're also useful for, there are many good prospects for quantum computation. I don't work in this field, but much more interestingly, I think, they're also miniature universes. So like quantum electrodynamics. So that's the, let me just finish here. So entanglement entropy, as I argue, it's an interesting non-local order parameter for detecting various things. For example, you can tell whether a phase is topologically ordered or not. You can detect properties of anions. You can determine phase diagrams of strongly interacting gauge theories. And as I argued near the end, there are also some generalization to non-relativistic systems, but it's a wide open question. So. You can read this. I mean, I don't have to say, but there's some.
Thanks a lot, Tarun, for this wonderful colloquium. Let's see if there are many questions. I think I have to come and give you the microphone.
Are there any aspects of quantum spin liquids that cannot be understood in terms of this parton constructions?
So there is recent work by Jiangwan Ha. At least I don't understand in parton construction that these spin liquids or whatever, they're not pseudo-symmetric, so I won't call them spin liquid. They're topologically ordered phases, which is called cubic model, Jiangwan Ha's cubic model. Maybe you understand it in parton construction. I don't. I have some vague understanding, but I think they look very different. They have some properties which don't, like ground state degeneracy depends on the system size, for example. So that's one class of systems which I think are like that. And I would say even gapless spin liquids, we understand so little about gapless spin liquids that it's possible that this whole description is, at least for the relativistic case, we have some control, like QD3 or QCD3. But when they are Fermi surfaces, we don't have a very deep understanding of these things. So.
More questions?
You said something about using this F theorems or C theorems to diagnose entanglement or not, confinement versus deconfinement. You might have said this, but if you did, I missed it. Does this apply also in 3+1, like to standard QCD? Is there version of it where you
derive
the same
thing?
Yeah,
I said it very briefly. It was just a sort of almost footnote. So it's there in the slide, but I said it too fast. So if you have 2+1D QCD.
3+1.
Oh, 3+1, of course.
3+1.
So that's old work. That's A theorem. Yeah, so in fact, when you look at the first paper on A theorem by John Cardi. He looked at, checked all the things that it's consistent at least. Yeah, so you can use similar arguments in all dimensions, but yeah.
So does it give exactly the same result, or is it just a bound, or is it?
I think it's I don't recall, but it's consistent. I don't remember how strong the bound was, but he checked that it's consistent with that when he expected asymptotic freedom, it matches.
Okay.
But the one thing I should mention is that in 3 plus 1D, it's less subtle, the argument, because the free photon theory is conformal in 3 plus 1D. So you can just start from UV fixed point where it's just free photons and fermions and apply these things. But in 2 plus 1D, free photons are not conformal. So you have to go through the argument, much more subtle argument. You have to think through the whole RG structure. I can go in detail how I did. You can also read in the paper. This argument is much more subtle than 2 plus 1D. So that's why, in fact, I first went through this thing, the supersymmetry argument, which you don't need in 3 plus 1D.
Any other question? All right, if there are no more questions, then let's thank Tarun again.